Packet Pushers.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Packet Protector, the podcast at the intersection of networking and security. I'm Jennifer Manella, a.k.a. JJ, here with Drew Conry-Murray, a.k.a. The Drew, and today we're talking about personal privacy tools.
Yeah, I thought this would be an interesting episode for folks considering upping their personal privacy for whatever reason. So JJ and I did some thinking about things we want to talk about. And JJ, I think maybe let's start with messaging apps, like mobile phone messaging apps, because that's kind of where a lot of the focus is these days.
Yeah, and we have a bunch. And so I think this is a really interesting topic. And I think it's timely because we've had a lot of different regulations happening throughout the world. Obviously, Drew and I are here in the US. There's a lot of stuff shaken in other parts of the world that we're partially privy to. So we're going to try to cover a little bit of everything here. But at least the main apps that I think of when I think of messaging apps are going to be Signal, WhatsApp. I did find an article that referenced Wicker, and I had completely forgotten about Wicker.
I don't even know what Wicker is, so you're ahead of me there.
And then, of course, I've heard of, but not used, Telegram, which we'll talk about in a little bit. I know for you Apple people who like your fruits, there's iMessaging. I'm trying to think if we're missing any of the other big ones.
Those are the ones that I know of. And obviously, if you've got your favorite messaging app, secure messaging app, you can hit us up packetpushers.net/FU and let us know what we missed.
Yeah. And you guys, we do also really like Slack. So if you go over to the packetpushers.net and you find the community section, you can join the Packet Pushers Slack. And there is a channel in there for this podcast. We'd love to have you there and continue some of the conversations and get your thoughts on things, because this is going to be an evolving topic over the next months and probably a couple of years. So let's start with Signal. So Signal is my preferred app. Now, I have several installed and I use them with different people for different reasons. I'm going to just go ahead and lay this out there, because I think the first thing that comes to mind when we talk about end-to-end encrypted messaging and privacy is there's two camps of people, right? I think some people are like, well, if you're not doing anything bad, who cares who has access to your stuff? And then, of course, there's, you know, the privacy side of things, which is kind of like, F you people, I want to be private. Nobody needs to know whatever messaging I'm sending to my friends, family, business partners, et cetera. And I think there's validity to both of those.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just as a citizen, at least here in the US, you do have an expectation of privacy and a right to privacy in some ways. And so you are allowed to enforce that using legal tools, which Signal is one of them. Yes, they can be used by criminals for nefarious purposes, but criminals can use anything for nefarious purposes. It doesn't mean we also shouldn't be given the opportunity to use these same tools to protect our privacy. And it's not just, you know, sort of the average privacy nerd or a regular citizen. There's also like journalists and activists and people who are in particular danger, like, you know, abused women or abused spouses or whatever, who also for very good reasons may want to have privacy tools available to them. So I understand there is a debate about particularly end-to-end encryption, because it does make life difficult potentially for law enforcement. But I am on the side of, if it's legal and allowed, we should be allowed to use it too for our own personal protection. So
yeah,
let's dive into Signal, because that's sort of the big one.
And I think this is what is at least currently considered the most secure from the standpoint of personal use and app, both in terms of how they establish an encrypted communication and then also what they do and do not provide to law enforcement. And part of that has to do with what they do and do not keep on their servers.
Right. Yeah. And I actually learned that Signal actually developed the Signal protocol. It used to be the TechSecure protocol, but it's now the Signal protocol, and other apps use it as well, which we'll get into. But yeah, you can start there.
Yeah, the double ratchet algorithm. We need some kind of hand signal or motion when we talk about the double ratchet algorithm, or you just got to say it like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're talking about elliptic curve, Diffie-Hellman, then AES for the symmetric part of the encryption. And one of the, not interesting, but one of the good things about this is it's actually, in my mind, when I think about it, very similar to some of the newer Wi-Fi security protocols we have with like WPA3, where we have things like perfect forward secrecy. It is more immune to decrypt. The keys are rotating or ratcheting.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, each message or however they're segmenting that up is using a different encryption key. So if you get one, you're not going to be able to decrypt stuff before or after that message.
Again, another reason why I like the Signal app, they really thought about this protocol. And it's also an open source protocol. So cryptographers and experts have looked at it and said, yeah, it sort of does what it says it does.
Yeah. I mean, anytime we talk about encryption, when we talk about something that's open source, standard, I'm air quoting, peer reviewed, it is going to be more secure than somebody's proprietary protocol for something. So there's the encryption algorithm and the key exchanges, which I think we can all probably agree to that Signal's done a fantastic job there. But then there's the where the message messages sent, stored, transmitted, and then where are the keys living? So if you're talking about end-to-end encryption between the two users and devices, that's where the keys are living.
On the endpoint device.
Yeah, on the endpoint device. And in certain messaging apps, iCloud, even WhatsApp has some cloud syncing stuff, those keys might live other places. And that is definitely something to consider.
Right. That's not the case with Signal though, right?
Correct. So you send messages on Signal. You can delete messages, but I think that just deletes it on your phone. But then there's the disappearing messages that automatically removes it from both ends at some predetermined time that somebody sets.
Yeah, that's a good distinction to know because you can obviously delete messages, but as you mentioned, it only deletes off your device. There is a disappearing message feature where if you set it up, you can pick a specific amount of time you want that message to exist, and then it will vanish from your phone and also from the recipient, whoever you sent it to, whether they want that feature on or not. You as the sender get to decide if you want disappearing messages, although it is a feature you have to explicitly set up. You can't, I think, at a later date decide, oh, I wish I had set disappearing for that message and make it go away. I don't think you can do that.
Well, at least this is the way it worked the last time I did this on Signal. If you set disappearing messages within the same group or to the same person, once the messages, even if they were sent before, hit that period, they will disappear.
Yes.
In that group.
Yeah.
Which I do want to say to everybody is different and actually real from a disappearing deletion standpoint than Snapchat and some of the other things that are supposed to be more ephemeral. Mm-hmm. But in reality, those messages, they disappear from your view in the app, but they are still on the provider's server. Mm-hmm. That's not what Signal does because they don't have the encryption decrypt keys. So they keep the message in their system, right, in that data path just long enough to get it delivered, and then that's gone.
Right.
So it truly is gone unless you were doing something like backing it up or screenshotting it or something else.
Right. That's the one place where this disappearing message or end-to-end encryption falls apart. The recipient can screenshot the message and it will live on their phone and they can do what they want with it. So that's one of the holes. There's not really anything I think Signal could do about that. One thing though, JJ, I was trying to find and I couldn't online is what Signal means by disappearing or deleting a message. Like, how is that happening? Is it an overwrite? I couldn't find anything. I don't know if you know anything about, or it's just sort of like checkmarked on your phone. The next time we, you know, take out the trash or whatever, it gets deleted. I don't know how that actually happens. I don't know if you have any insight into that.
Well, it literally just disappears. Not that we're showing video here, but like literally, totally just like disappear. It'll be like, it was there. And then you look at it and it's like, totally gone. Like, oh my God, where'd it go?
You're possessed there for a second.
Yeah. You look in there and you'll still see the timestamps. Mm-hmm. And you'll still see, I'm going to call it system messages from within the app. So because of the way the encryption tunnels work, there are identifiers that Signal calls safety numbers. If you change your phone or reinstall the app or do something that changes that unique identifier, kind of like an install ID. Uh-huh. On most software. If that changes on the other end, you'll get a notification and that's timestamped, et cetera. All of that is persistent in that chat stream, but the actual messages itself will simply just cease to exist in that app.
Okay. So yeah, that's what I was wondering. Does that deletion or disappearing happen at that moment? Or could I, if I had access to the endpoint device, find it on that phone's hard drive somewhere before it actually got overwritten or that memory block freed up for something else to get on top of it?
Yeah. Now, if you're talking about actually getting into the hardware aspect of like almost forensics and recovery off of that data storage, possibly. I don't know the answer to that is a short answer.
Okay.
I've definitely seen one of the conferences I go to and speak at is the Technosecurity Digital Forensics and Investigations Conference. And they have one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast. And that conference, very long running conference, law enforcement from all over the world comes to it. Mm-hmm. And so it's a lot of mobile device forensics. So I see and hear and learn some interesting things just sponging off of that. Mm-hmm. So I do know that there are things they can do. But yeah, my understanding is once it's gone, it's gone. Now, again, if you get it to the hardware level, can you recover certain things? Yeah, possibly.
Okay. Yeah, I guess that was the thrust of my question.
Yeah.
So the other thing about these secure messaging apps, even if they are using complete end-to-end encryption, there is metadata still associated with these conversations. Regarding Signal, what metadata they collect and what they report to law enforcement, according to them, all they collect and all they will share with law enforcement with a subpoena or a warrant is, quote, Unix timestamps for when each account was created and the date that each account last connected to the Signal service. It does not store message metadata like time of date, call length, who you were contacting, all of that. It's just the timestamp for when the account was created and the last time your Signal device connected to the Signal service. So not a lot.
Yeah, that's good, right? I mean,
yeah.
From a privacy perspective, it's good because they can't provide something to law enforcement that they don't have.
Right.
And it's interesting in the world of security, because when we talk about, you know, regulations and compliance, there's this double-edged sword of the more data you have and the longer you have it. That's why we have data retention policies. It becomes a liability instead of an asset in many ways, because you might be asked for that data. Mm-hmm. And of course, obviously, there's the risk of it could be, you know, stolen or ransomed, et cetera. So unless there's something that dictates that these providers must keep and store a certain type of information, or the metadata you were talking about, you know, it's at their discretion as to what they do or don't do, and Signal chooses to not keep that. Again, it just doesn't exist.
Yeah, for a long time, I covered the e-discovery beat as a reporter and heard lots of stories about companies who had no obligation to keep data that they just kept because whatever, and it came back to bite them in a lawsuit or whatever. So,
oh, that's interesting. You guys listening, if you want to in on this, we'll let you in on it. But a lot of the advising I do to CISOs and security teams is around e-discovery. There's legal aspects of it that a lot of times the technology side, they don't consider.
Yeah.
And there's lots of great resources. One of the trainings I do for IONS is basically, you know, how to create BYOD programs. And it takes into account the legal considerations and e-discovery considerations, which are probably enough to scare most people from wanting to do a BYOD program, organization and user, frankly. There's some crazy stories. There's one about Leonard Skinner that's pretty amazing about, okay, side quest, just like for 1 minute.
Okay.
But Cleopatra Films was found guilty and had to stop producing a movie they were going to produce. It was a biopic from the Leonard Skinner story, because they were charged with spoliation of evidence because one of their people was communicating with, I think, like the director or producer, somebody who was a third party that was contracted to do the film, right? Not an employee.
Yep.
They were communicating over text messages. That person who was a contractor switched phones, lost the text messages, and they were found guilty of not doing what they needed to do to keep control over those communications. Uh-huh. So interesting stories. And sometimes these manifest in like multi-million dollar charges and lawsuits for different things. But the world of e-discovery and the legal requirements around that are really interesting. And they do come into play in messaging apps too.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah, we should maybe do a whole show on e-discovery, because the intersection between the legal requirements and the technological requirements are significant.
Yeah. And the tie-in to this really is that companies specifically have, you know, legal requirements for e-discovery about, you know, what they need to make sure if there's unique information on a device. So back to the messaging app thing. If you're using WhatsApp or Signal or something like that, and you're communicating with your coworkers or customers or business partners or something through that, the organization has a duty to archive that and have access to it for a specific period of time,
right,
even on a personal device. So there's actually a whole list of apps for e-discovery support for messaging apps, meaning like Smarsh, Global Relay, Telemessage, or a few that we've talked about with clients before. So they are designed to kind of snap into these, and sometimes even into like ChatGPT, those kind of platforms, uh-huh, and give the organization a certain amount of control and visibility and archival ability on that device, whether it be personally owned or corporate owned, which is a whole other can of worms, right?
Yeah.
So we'll just keep that worm can closed for the moment.
We'll visit that can another day.
Yeah. So let's go into WhatsApp.
Yeah. So aside from Signal, WhatsApp, frankly, might be the most popular messaging app on the planet. It's used all over the world. It supports text, voice, video. It was originally an independent project. It got acquired by Facebook/Meta. And in 2016, WhatsApp did add end-to-end encryption. And the mechanism it used is the Signal protocol, also used by Signal. So it does have a fairly robust end-to-end encryption capability, except in some cases, as you mentioned, JJ, when there is, like, I think there's a business API and cloud API that you can use with Meta where they say this technically does not count as end-to-end encryption. And if that's an issue for you, you're going to have to dive into that can of worms yourself.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing to note is that even though it's end-to-end encrypted, WhatsApp is a little bit more free with the metadata that it shares, particularly with Meta, because it is owned by Meta. According to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, WhatsApp shares with Meta things like the phone number, logs of how often you use WhatsApp, IP addresses, contacts on your device, and device identifiers. I also looked up WhatsApp. If the law enforcement reaches out to them with a pen register or tap and trace, you don't get the message content, but they will start collecting logs and call logs for a particular user, including who the communication was to or from, the time it was transmitted, from which IP address, and the type of communication, such as a text or call. And they can give that information to law enforcement almost in real time under a, you know, legal pen register or tap and trace order.
Yeah. None of that makes me warm and fuzzy on the inside. I mean, even just the contacts on your device and the device identifiers. I mean, that...
That can tell you a lot, yeah.
Yeah, I don't love that.
Yeah, and I will note that WhatsApp does also offer disappearing messages. You can set messages to disappear after 24 hours, after 7 days, or after 90 days. However, either participant in a chat can keep messages on their end, even if you have set it to disappear. So unlike Signal, where you can decide, I want this message wiped regardless, if you're using WhatsApp, disappearing doesn't necessarily enforce it on the other person's device. How about iMessage JJ? Because that's probably also a very popular messaging app.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of data around this. I'm a Windows and Android gal over here. I don't really use iMessage. I am the green bubble, people. I am that green bubble. But I think any of these that you are syncing, every time I say syncing like that, I think about, we have a TV ad here and the guy's got a German accent and he's like, what are you syncing about? Anyway, anytime you're syncing things to the cloud, if the keys being used are being synced to the cloud somewhere, and it may be a different cloud, then there's always a risk of putting those things together. And so one of the interesting things I think I saw in one of the documents is like WhatsApp messages can be backed up to iCloud or Google or any of those kind of services. So if there's a subpoena or a warrant to WhatsApp, whoever asks for that's not going to be able to get the decrypted messages. Uh-huh. But if they subpoena iCloud or Google or whatever you're backing up to that then does have the key, they could successfully get the key from that platform.
Right.
And then get the messages that were encrypted within the WhatsApp platform and put that together and get decrypted messages.
I think WhatsApp does allow you to encrypt your backups. If you want to back up your chats, you can decide to encrypt it, but that's a feature you have to turn on. I don't think it happens automatically.
Oh, so we've talked about e-discovery. I think the other sort of weird spinoff of the encrypted messaging app conversation is, well, first of all, how many people are using it? So some of the data that's floating around there is like almost 90% of the world's internet users are using encrypted messaging app at least once a month. So pretty regularly. Uh-huh. And because of that, you know, a lot of them have spun up. So we've talked about, you know, WhatsApp and Signal and iMessage. We've had a few others spin up that are kind of used for more nefarious purposes. So I'm actually going to mention Telegram here. There's another one called Ghost. I'm sure there's others that I'm just not even privy to here. But at that same conference I was talking about a minute ago, one of the sessions that I sat in on and listened to was a pair of researchers talking about Telegram. And a lot of people, I think, consider it to be a messaging app, but it's jokingly kind of referred to as like the dark web in your pocket. And some of the stats they had around the shrinkage of the dark web, I'm kind of air quoting dark web behavior and activities, has constricted down to something so small that a lot of law enforcement doesn't even mess with it at this point. And a lot of that has shifted over to Telegram because Telegram has, you know, messaging, kind of group messaging the way that we might have in like Slack channels. That's not an exact correlation, but you kind of get the picture. Uh-huh. And they even have their own currency.
Oh, really?
And so because of that, you can conduct business in this ecosystem that is, in theory, not traceable. Uh-huh. But it's been, you know, kind of commonly used for criminal activities now in bulk. We'll drop these links in the show notes. One, not a researcher, I don't think, but actually just a reporter, I think, was doing a story on Telegram and was talking about how, I don't know if it's a he or she or they joined and were kind of adding into a group or two to sort of get the feel for things and then sort of just got invited to a lot of groups, all based on criminal activities of buying and selling, you know, credit card or personal information and drugs. And actually the founder, chief executive officer of Telegram was recently arrested in France for just being negligent.
Right. Yeah, that's the charges. Yeah. And again, this gets back to sort of the two double-edged sword of encryption. It can be used for your own personal protection. It can be used for things like protecting your financial information. It can also be used by criminals to do bad things.
But the fallout of that is then, you know, law enforcement agencies across the world are starting to demand of these messaging providers some, I don't want to call it a backdoor, but some way into the ecosystem so that they can thwart criminal activities.
Right.
At least in my sphere of knowledge, Australia has been one of the more active and vocal. Let me back up to that Ghost thing because there's Telegram and Ghost were the two big ones that I'm familiar with criminal activities. And I think in the show notes, we've got a Europol link where I think it was 9 different countries participated in sort of choking out this one platform that was being used for nefarious purposes, as you said. But then we have Australia's, it was a TOLA legislation, and I can't remember what that stands for, but basically giving, you know, law enforcement access into these various, you know, encrypted tools so that they could keep people being legal and enforce law and catch criminals. And I think between, you know, Europe and Australia heading that way, you know, one of the fears that we have here is, are we going to be living in a world where we're fighting for our own privacy because law enforcement is able to make the case that our personal privacy does not trump the greater good
right.
of enforcing law?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's a perpetual fight that citizens and governments have between personal privacy and privacy protections versus law enforcement and being able to catch criminals doing stuff. It's not going to stop. And in fact, it's probably going to get worse. So, yeah.
And I'm torn on this. Like, I totally understand going after platforms like Ghost, platforms like Telegram. I think that if a platform, and again, you know, I think it was a shot across the bow to other people. So Pavel Durov, I found the little quote here.
That's the CEO of Telegram. Yeah.
Yeah, the CEO of Telegram. Charged for suspected complicity in allowing illicit transactions, drug trafficking, fraud, and the spread of child sex abuse images to flourish on his site. I think most of us would argue apps like Signal are just not set up to do that. Could you do something malicious? You know, could you make some arrangements that were criminal? Yes. Are you doing it in bulk? Is that platform supported? No.
If you tied some kind of cryptocurrency to your app, sure, then it becomes much more appealing.
I feel like there's a future where we can have platforms that give us the privacy that we deserve in our communities, but aren't enabling criminals to operate at scale.
So I also want to make sure we get some time to talk about personal VPNs. And JJ, I know you are an avid VPN user. There's a million VPNs out there, and I didn't want to sort of go through them one by one because that would take forever. But I think one thing I did want to talk about is, what should you be looking for when you're trying to decide if you want to use a personal VPN? Because there are issues to be aware of. Things that I found to keep in mind are things like, where is the company headquartered? And what are the privacy laws of that country that will have an impact? What kind of logs does the company keep? What countries is it hosting its VPN servers in? What are the relevant laws there? And if you're using a free version, what information is being collected about you in exchange for that freeness?
Yeah, and I was just scrolling back through, I think it was around episode 26-ish, maybe when we talked about working from anywhere. Mm-hmm. Where we talked a little bit about personal VPNs. So go check that out. We've talked about VPNs in different contexts a few times, so I'm not going to repeat that. But similar to just understanding like the messaging apps, the same thing, right? What data is it keeping? Who has access to it, et cetera, et cetera. When you talk about these VPN providers, when we talk about a virtual private network and a tunnel, there have to be two established, at least two established ends of the tunnel mm-hmm. that are communicating. So that can be something you have installed. Let's say it's an endpoint that you have with an agent on it. The other end of that could be something at your house, you know, or your home office or whatever, through a firewall that you manage or a piece of software that you manage. But more commonly, the personal VPN solutions are terminating into a cloud uh-huh. as a service. So a VPN is a service that you're subscribing to.
Yep.
And I think that's, I hate to say the riskier of the two, but obviously if it's terminating into somebody's cloud, that other organization or provider has access to some amount of information by nature of hosting a service.
Yes.
I use a cloud-hosted VPN service. The one that I use is iVPN. I'll just be very blatant about that. It's one of several that you don't even have to sign up with an email address. You get a unique long string as an identifier. And I'm mentioning this because it is a model that others can use or you can look for if anonymity is important to you. Now, that doesn't protect you if you're doing something illegal. The authorities will still have ways of figuring out where you're sourcing from. But from a privacy perspective, it's pretty interesting because you get a unique identifier for your account and you can use that identifier instead of, let's say, an email address or a phone number or something, or even a username. But yeah, looking at where that entity is located, you know, as a personal preference, I would not, you know, there are several countries in the world or regions in the world that I would not trust having my data terminated, you know, places like China, certain sections of the Middle East, probably other parts of Asia, potentially. So you have to do what's comfortable for you. If the company is based in and terminates, you know, their connections in Europe or North America somewhere, and that's what's comfortable, then that's what you need to be looking for.
Yeah, one of the ones I was looking at was called Proton VPN. They do Proton Mail as well. They are headquartered in Switzerland and run their servers out of Switzerland and Germany.
Yeah, and the where they run the servers is important because...
Where's the physical server? Yeah, there's the headquarters and then there's the physical server, yeah.
And they both matter.
Right, two different jurisdictions. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, when it comes to stuff like that, yeah, free is never free.
Right. I feel like if you are going to go in on a VPN, you might as well pay for it. Do your homework first. But if you are doing free, then they're extracting something from you to provide that service for you.
You are the product.
Yes.
If it's free, you are the product. Yeah. And they don't need to be expensive. I think, you know, like $3 to $5 a month for reputable, you know, paid versions. You're not talking about $30 a month for services like this. It's not stupid expensive.
Yeah, exactly. The last thing, JJ, I want to talk about is, of course, Tor. Tor is sort of a classic privacy mechanism. It's to help you disguise your internet or web browsing. Essentially, you connect to a relay site that encrypts your connection and then passes your connection to other relay sites before exiting to your actual destination. The idea is to help hide your browsing from your ISP or from people maybe snooping on you. Obviously, the ISP can see you hitting a Tor relay, but not where you go next or what you do next.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the other options that I think is viable if you have use cases for this. Personally, I have a very neutral feeling about Tor. Mm-hmm. I tend to use VPNs as my obfuscation tool mm-hmm. versus Tor, with the understanding that it's not the same thing. But for my use cases, I don't want my ISP, or if I'm traveling, other people in the vicinity necessarily, or the data path, knowing what I'm accessing mm-hmm. for various reasons. And again, we've talked about this in past episodes, but Tor definitely kind of cranks that up to a different level and can route and hop through different things. So I don't know, Drew, in some of the work you've done before, do you use Tor?
I do not use Tor. I feel like it was one of the sort of original privacy tools that emerged in the early days of the internet. It's been around for a long time. It may have been sort of surpassed by things like end-to-end encryption and VPNs, but it's still out there. It's still functioning. It's a nonprofit project, so moving along. And they now have a downloadable browser because it was kind of hard to set up, I think, in the early days, but now you can just get it as a browser if you want to do that. Although I think you should also know that Tor can introduce latency if performance is an issue for you. But still out there, still going, and I'm glad to see it's still going. And I did read some articles about folks who might use a VPN and Tor together for that added layer of security, although I can't imagine what that does to your traffic, but in terms of latency.
Yeah, it has been around for a while, and I didn't realize exactly how long. So it actually was developed in the 90s uh-huh. at a Naval Research Lab, and it was first released to the public in 2002.
Yep.
It's 20 years old.
It's old.
Dang.
Yeah, I think one of the researchers who worked on it at the Naval Lab was also at MIT and developed a separate project at MIT sort of based on the theory around it. So a Tor did come out of MIT, but is now a standalone nonprofit.
Yeah, longevity there. And I think all of these things, you know, a lot of people listening, if you work in security and you work in, you know, infrastructure architecture, we tend to be more privacy and security conscious than maybe than our peers that do other things in the world. So this is one of those things where it's a, you know, choose your own adventure based on your comfort level. And there are definitely viable use cases and reasons for somebody that wants this level of all of this, not just Tor, but all of these different levels of privacy and protection, I think are important. You gave several examples of reporters.
Reporters.
Keep wanting to call them researchers because you guys do so much research. It's kind of the same thing. But reporters, there are some interesting legal battles and criminal charges that have occurred. I think one of the examples was that there was a whistleblower, you know, trying to get information to a reporter and they were using WhatsApp. And I think the person was in the Senate at the time, maybe. So they both thought, you know, WhatsApp was okay and safe. So this person was not trying to sell, you know, state secrets to a foreign government. This person in the federal government was trying to help do right by the country. Mm-hmm. by being a whistleblower and draw attention to something that was, you know, should not have been happening, but, you know, ended up sharing stuff with the reporter in a way that was in WhatsApp able to be recovered by other entities, including law enforcement. And there was, you know, jail time and imprisonment involved in that.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that I follow a lot of reporters on social media. A lot of them, if they give out contact information, it's via Signal. So it's been recognized by reporters, particularly doing like, you know, political reporting, global reporting, security reporting, that they recognize that Signal is sort of the choice for them.
Yeah. I mean, when I provide information to reporters, I wrap it in an envelope and then I put it in a McDonald's bag. And we meet at the park and I drop it off behind the third bench and then they pick it up 10 minutes later. It's a great system.
It is, yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I'm going to just switch to Signal though.
We'll cut down on the number of trips you have to make to McDonald's.
Oh, yeah. I guess I could switch to like a fast food restaurant that's not disgusting and maybe.
Panera. Try Panera.
Yeah, I can't eat gluten and wheat, so.
Oh, okay. A salad place.
Yeah, I guess it is a salad place. Well, I think we've covered a lot here, and we've got tons of links in the show notes if you guys want to dig into more information.
Ton of links.
There's also a really neat kind of one-pager that was released and some write-ups about it. I think in here you've got it listed as FBI document says the feds can get your WhatsApp data. So there's a Rolling Stone article, but out of that also there's a propertyofthepeople.org that published. They did a lot of digging and a FOIA request to get this information, but it's not just WhatsApp. It kind of covers all of the different messaging apps and what the FBI and other entities can get access to through subpoenas.
Yeah, and I will say that they can't get the content of your messages. It is about the metadata, but there's varying degrees of metadata they can get, and then what they can do with the metadata is the issue. So it's not, the FBI hasn't cracked Signal or WhatsApp per se. It's not about the content of the message. It's still a metadata conversation, despite the headline, which is a little more alarming sounding.
Yep.
So yeah, tons of links in the show notes. One of the other things that I found was a really good actually overview of how WhatsApp uses the Signal protocol in their communication. So if you're really curious about what's going on under the hood, we'll have that link to the white paper, a bunch of other stuff. And as always, if you have your favorite privacy tool, you want to share it with us, hit us up, packetpushers.net/FU. We'll follow it up in another show. And as JJ mentioned, packetpushers.net/community. We have a Slack channel there if you want to just get on the conversation, talk with other folks in real time or asynchronously, you can do that there.
Sorry, I'm going to interrupt you while you're talking about social media and connection stuff. I know a lot of people recently have maybe decided to get off of Twitter permanently, or the X, if that's what we're calling it. I'm still there as JJX. I'm also on Blue Sky and Mastodon, and I think you're in one or both of those as well.
I have left Twitter officially. I'm gone. I deleted my account, but I am on Blue Sky. Yeah, so come look us up.
Ooh.
Yeah, not JJ. I will find you there. Yep.
Yeah. We're both there.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us for this episode of Packet Protector. As I mentioned, we always love your follow-up. Hit us back at packetpushers.net/FU. If you have a comment, if we got something wrong here, you just want to let us know some more information, or if you have a show idea, we always love to hear it. And just a reminder, the FU is for follow-up. We do appreciate when listeners reach out. As always, eat your security vegetables. Mm-hmm.